From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The skeleton of an idea came to the writer Anthony Doerr about 10 years ago. He was 80 feet underground. He was on the subway when a man nearby had a call drop when he was talking on his cell phone. And it was the man's reaction that struck Doerr. He was angry that this remarkable miracle of technology had failed him. So Doerr got to thinking about that, about hearing the voice of a stranger from far off. And the fragment of a story came to him. It didn't have many details at the time, but there was a boy trapped somewhere in the darkness, and there was a girl reading something to him over the radio. The idea became a novel that has gotten a lot of attention, and today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Anthony Doerr about it. It's called All the Light We Cannot See, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It takes quite a few pages before the main characters actually encounter each other in Anthony Doerr's new novel, but everything is preparing you for that moment. Marie is a young girl living in Paris. Werner is 300 miles away, living in an orphanage in a coal mining town in Germany. The story plays out during World War II, during the Nazi invasion of France. The novel is about their lives, and it is full of light. Light as a metaphor, light as a scientific principle, the light of awareness, the lack of light. There's even a mysterious diamond, which is like a piece of light. The novel is called All the Light We Cannot See, and today in the program we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had with Anthony Doerr. This was back in June. He's going to be in Utah next week as part of the Utah Humanity Council's 2014 Book Festival. Anthony Doerr is the author of two books of short stories and a memoir and a previous novel called About Grace. Anthony Doerr, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Well, I know you've told the story, and I mentioned this in the introduction of how the idea first came to you. And I want to spend a few minutes with that because I wanted to get a sense. So there's this guy kind of griping about the fact that his cell phone cut out, which struck you as what, kind of ironic, like, dude, it's a cell phone. You're talking to someone in a subway, you know. So what was the thing that struck you about that?
Yeah, so that's funny to remember that. We were on a train from Princeton to New York City. We're going to Penn Station. You start going underground, and steel and concrete are flowing above us. This is 2004, so he's on his 2004 cell phone, you know. And he's talking about the sequel to the movie The Matrix. I'll never forget that. And his call drops, and he kind of looks at it, and then he started rapping it with his knuckles, and he got angry. He got really embarrassingly, unreasonably angry. And after I stopped worrying about my safety for a second, I thought not only what he's forgetting, but what all of us are forgetting is that what he's doing is an utter miracle. He's using these little packets of light relaying between towers miles apart, and he might be talking to somebody that's 1,000 miles away or 3,000 miles away for all I knew. Instantaneously, using the speed of light, they're having this conversation, just as our voices right now are traveling with invisible light to all these different radio sets. It's an incredible thing. So I thought, here's this little receiver and a transmitter. It's packed into this device, no bigger than a deck of cards. And yet he's capable of doing what for generations, thousands of generations of humans, we could never do, which is talk to somebody you couldn't see. And so that night, I was looking around for a new idea. I had just finished a book. And that night, I wrote down the title, All the Light We Cannot See. And as you mentioned in the intro, you know, it was a long time before I understood that this was going to be in World War II and that who Marie was and who Werner was. But that's what I started with, is that power of radio and using invisible light to carry human voices.
So I described it as a fragment. So it was a fragment. So you knew there was a girl and you knew there was a boy and you knew there was a radio involved.
I conceived of him as trapped, which he ultimately is because of this siege of this town called Saint-Malo in France. And I conceived of her as blind. I didn't really know why. I still don't quite understand why I made that choice, but I thought that fit, that in a sense, she had more power than he did. He's trapped in darkness, but she's the one with the transmitter. I didn't originally know what story it would be. It was until about probably 5 years into writing the book that I settled on 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne, that that's what she would read to him. And this kind of adventure story that would be very compelling for young people in particular. And it's kind of about being trapped. You know, the main character in that novel is trapped on the submarine. So I just kind of started falling in love with this idea of these two people who are, so separate, really from opposite sides of the war. Yeah. And in terms of resistance, the way Marie's great uncle is using radio as a tool of resistance. And here Werner's whole job in the German army is to find illicit radio transmissions, hunt them down and eradicate them. And to try to see like how I could play with this use of radio and light and both sides of the war and tell this kind of binary story.
Did it surprise you how powerful radio was and I suppose still is? But, I was thinking about the genocide in Rwanda was so powerfully influenced by a voice from a radio.
And supposedly, there were maps of the levels of violence by how clear the radio reception was in Rwanda. I learned that while researching this book. It has nothing to do with the novel.
No, at all.
Amazingly, I mean, it's amazing that that's what is seeding knowledge. And in the case of especially poor people in Germany in the 30s leading up to the war, propaganda. You know, there were these receivers called the people's receivers. They were state-subsidized radio. So if you were a middle-income, low-income family, this is the only radio you could afford. And it really only received two or three big national stations, and they were telling you what they wanted to tell you. And if you didn't have the training to think critically, you believe a lot of the things they were telling you.
It was the party line. And then Werner hears some of this in these early days. And there's the incredibly anti-Semitic radio plays that play out. You know,
yeah, meant for children. Like these are stories, and yet the villains all have big noses or something, or they're jewelers, and the policemen are all handsome and blonde, and it's terrifying, so insidious. And what not only what I'm getting at is what we take for granted is our cell phones and our access to information, but think about how if we want, we can find 500 different viewpoints on the civil rights movement in 20 minutes on the internet. And to have such restricted access to information really compelled me, the idea that maybe I should try to show some empathy, at least for some of the German citizens growing up during the Third Reich.
Let me ask you about Marie's father. He's this locksmith at the National Museum of Natural History there in Paris. Did you go there? Did you wander around there?
I did. I wandered all around, yeah.
Because I was looking at pictures of it this morning, and it that must have sparked your imagination.
Yes, yeah. In fact, and then I went back to try to make sure I was getting the right details. And, you know, not only the museums themselves, but the Garden of Plants is an amazing place to just wander these old gravel paths and sycamore trees everywhere and these huge tulip beds. And there's a zoo. There's a whole labyrinth, a hedge labyrinth with this incredible gazebo at the top. That's actually where the novel ends. The last paragraph of the novel is up in this gazebo. Yeah, really a place fertile for imagination. As soon as I started wandering through there and I read that keys, you know, before electronic magnetic key cards, that everything had to be locked. There's so many things of value there. And I knew I wanted to set it in the war at that point. And I had read a lot about the Louvre and what was happening at the Louvre in terms of taking, you know, Rembrandts and Da Vinci's out of the Louvre into the countryside to try to protect them from the advance of the German army. I started wondering what was happening at the Natural History Museum with all these gems, these fossils, these meteorites, all these things of incalculable value. You know, what was happening with those things?
It's interesting you write about the routine of Marie and her father there when she's young. He helps her get dressed. He tells her to tie her shoes. They have this cup of coffee in the morning together, which he says you can have as much sugar in it as you want. I mean, they have this kind of routine for their life. And he's trying to – there's this moment later where he kind of confesses the sliver of panic about being her father. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that relationship because it's so tender. It's so lovely. But he feels this deep sense of – responsibility for her.
Sure. He works really hard with her on what my father-in-law would call self-sufficiency training. You know, he's always working with her on tying her shoes. He builds these elaborate models of her neighborhood to try to get her to understand which street intersects which street and how many park benches or lampposts would be on her block. he's always working with her on reading too, and trying to get her to, you know, Braille books were so expensive, but he gets her Braille readers and eventually starts buying her one book a year to try to get her to start engaging intellectually with novels. Oh, yeah, I suppose with Father's Day coming up, you know, a lot of this came from these feelings I have. Even if my wife, say, goes out of town, you know, there is this sliver of panic, like it's all on me.
Yeah.
Like I've got to keep them alive. And it's a wonderful feeling, you know. I love being with my children, and they show me the world in so many ways. And I think that's what Marie helps do for her father, too, is to show her a different way of seeing the world.
Yeah.
I hope that's what she does for the reader, too.
Well, I want to have you read a section. This is a her father, as you say, has built this really intricate scale model of their neighborhood. And at first, you talk about how this model really makes no sense to her in some way. In fact, she's mixing up the real neighborhood and the miniature in her mind. But her father is trying to get her to make this connection. So they go out. And I guess he spins her around and says, take us home.
Yeah, every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday. And time after time after time, she blows it. She fails. It doesn't work. But then there's this moment when, and I want to have you read this section if you would, she gets it. Do you want to say something
else
about that?
Great setup. You're very good at the setup. Thank you, Doug. Her father stirs the keys in his pockets. Ahead loom the tall grand houses that flank the gardens, reflecting sound. She says, we go left. They start up the length of the Rue Cuvier. A trio of airborne ducks threads toward them, flapping their wings in synchrony, making for the Seine. And as the birds rush overhead, she imagines she can feel the light settling over their wings, striking each individual feather. Left on the Rue Linné, right on the Rue d'Aubenton. Three storm drains, four storm drains, five. Approaching on the left will be the open ironwork fence of the Jardin des Plantes, with thin spars like the bars of a great birdcage. Across from her now, the bakery, the butcher, the delicatessen. Safe to cross, Papa? It is. Right, then straight. They walk up their street now. She is sure of it. One step behind her, her father tilts his head up and gives the sky a huge smile. Marie knows this, even though her back is to him, even though he says nothing, even though she is blind. Papa's thick hair is wet from the snow, and standing in a dozen angles off his head, and his scarf is draped asymmetrically over his shoulders, and he's beaming up at the falling snow. They are halfway up their street. They are outside their building. Marie finds the trunk of the chestnut tree that grows past her third-floor window, its bark beneath her fingers. Old friend. In another half-second, her father's hands are in her armpits, swinging her up, and Marie smiles, and he laughs a pure, contagious laugh, one she will try to remember all her life. Father and daughter, turning in circles on the sidewalk in front of their apartment house, laughing together while snow sifts through the branches above.
There's a where does Werner come from? I know you have this sort of hunch that it's a boy. Eventually you decide, oh, it's going to be a German soldier, because that really complicates it for obvious reasons, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But one thing you say about Werner in the book is that Werner seems to float.
Yes.
And you say he captures snowflakes and tadpoles and hibernating frogs. Now, I don't want to go too far with this, but wasn't that kind of like you when you were a kid?
Yeah, that's not going too far. He does come from a part of me for sure. He's obsessed with radios as a boy and fixing them and tinkering with them and repairing them. And I was using a lot of my own memories of playing with crystal radios. I loved the Cleveland Indians, of all things, growing up. And I'd love to, after my parents would go to bed, I'd sneak the crystal radio out and listen to the game kind of illicitly, you know, even though they would be losing almost for sure. Listen to them in bed. I was always curious about the natural world in the way I have Werner B. And yet I constrict his childhood so much in that he doesn't have parents like I had. He has very little access to information. And so when this one beam of light shines through in terms of his radio, he gets to hear these broadcasts about science from a Frenchman. And he's learned French from the house mother in his orphanage. His mind just opens up to the window of possibility in his life gets slightly larger. All boys in this coal mining town had to go work in the mines when they turned 15. This is the same mine that's killed his father. So he feels a kind of double entrapment there. And here is this one thing this radio has delivered to him, really education in a sense. And it's so, yeah, there's some part of me there. It's, you know, I loved learning about things. And, you know, I still do. I feel like we get such a short time on Earth. And why not learn about as many things as we can? Beetles and trees and lights and the mountains. And I want to learn about all these things. And, you know, I think, you know, what would it be like to get in to grow up in a society where maybe you're not allowed to be educated?
Well, it's funny because it's almost like this is kind of a theme in some of the things you write. I wanted to ask you about an essay you wrote called Butterflies on a Wheel. It was about this cross-country trip you had taken, or trips. There were like 16 of these trips you had taken. And there's this moment, which I wanted to ask you about, that you write about in the essay. Because the reason I think it's interesting is because there's this theme where you talk about being dazzled, or this idea of wonderment that seems to come up in your stories from time to time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, very much so. Maybe that's my main subject, is wonder.
Yeah, really? Because so set this story up for us, if you would, because it's such a remarkable moment. You're driving along, and all of a sudden, there's this cloud of butterflies.
Yeah. I was driving west for love. You know, I was in love. I was in my 20s, and I was going to graduate school, so I was crossing back and forth between Idaho and Ohio. It was going through Wyoming, and a pretty windy day, and, you know, your car is kind of shuddering in gusts of wind. And first I just see it in the distance, this kind of gray ribbon that it doesn't look like dust. You're not quite sure what it is. And as you approach closer, butterflies start smacking the windshield regularly, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, to the point where I kind of had to slow down to about 10 miles an hour. And you realize you're in this river, this migrating river of butterflies. And it was really probably years before I was able to write about it with any clarity. I just remember thinking it was as if the earth had torn open for a moment, the way it sometimes does, and just reveals this miracle to you if you're present enough to see it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I pulled over and was trying to identify them. You know, it's a holocaust of butterflies in one sense, but it's also there's so many of them that so many are continuing on, just riding the wind. I love seeing things like that, you know, big schools of fish. I write in the essay, I felt it a few times when kayaking up in Alaska, and these big humpback whales would come under the boats, and you feel like that shadow drags under the hull of your kayak forever, you know, in these trails of bubbles. You think this is something so much older and more ancient and vital than I am, and you're just so blessed to get to witness it for a moment.
You write that you said these were feelings that seemed to suggest the world possessed quantities of power I would never understand.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, these kind of miracles are so big, you just want to participate in them as much as understand them. I write about seashells a lot, and in this novel, they become quite important to Marie. And I always think eventually there's no answer for why they bother to be so beautiful. You know, these little animals are spinning these little polished miracles of calcium on their backs. And especially for a blind character, I think they have such tactile power that I really love writing those sections for Marie, having her kind of grow up and learn a little bit of science as much as she could by feeling things with her fingers.
I want to ask you to read something as we head into a break here. This, we're coming back to Werner here, and he and his sister find this discarded and beaten up radio. Behind a shed in this kind of grimy town where they live. And he's fascinated by it, obviously, and he studies it for hours and hours. I'm hearkening back to your childhood as you're sort of trying to fix these things or play with them. And he does fix it very carefully. He makes it work. And there's this moment that I want to have you read where it just kind of comes to life.
Yeah. And this is after all the other kids have given up on it, you know? And I remember that really clearly. My brother is an engineer, and He was so persistent in fixing things and seeing things through, and that's part of him is in Werner for sure. He hears a fizz of static, then from somewhere deep inside the earpiece, a stream of consonants issues forth. Werner's heart pauses. The voice seems to echo in the architecture of his head. The sound fades as quickly as it came. He shifts the pin a quarter inch, more static, another quarter inch, nothing. In the kitchen, Frau Elena kneads bread. Boys shout in the alley. Werner guides the tuning pin back and forth. Static, static. He is about to hand the earphone to Yutta, his sister, when, clear and unblemished, about halfway down the coil, he hears the quick, drastic strikes of a bow dashing across the strings of a violin. He tries to hold the pin perfectly still. A second violin joins the first. Yutta drags herself closer. She watches her brother with outsized eyes. A piano chases the violins, then woodwinds. The strings sprint, woodwinds fluttering behind. More instruments join in. Flutes? Harps? The song races, seems to loop back over itself. Verna? Yutta whispers. He blinks. He has to swallow back tears. The parlor looks the same as it always has. Two cribs beneath two Latin crosses. Dust floating in the open mouth of the stove. A dozen layers of paint peeling off the baseboards. A needlepoint of Frau Elena's snowy Alsatian village above the sink. Yet now there is music. As if inside Werner's head an infinitesimal orchestra has stirred to life. The room seems to fall into a slow spin. His sister says his name more urgently, and he presses the earphone to her ear. Music, she says. He holds the pin as stock still as he can. The signal is weak enough that, though the earphone is 6 inches away, he can't hear any trace of the song. But he watches his sister's face, motionless except for her eyelids. And in the kitchen, Frau Elena holds her flower-whitened hands in the air and cocks her head, studying Verna. And two older boys rush in and stop, sensing some change in the air. And the little radio, with its four terminals and trailing aerial, sits motionless on the floor between them all, like a miracle.
Anthony Doerr, his novel is called All the Light We Cannot See. We spoke with him back in June. Doerr is going to be in Utah next week for a pair of events as part of the Utah Humanity Council's 2014 Book Festival. We have all the details of those free events on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with the writer Anthony Doerr. He joined us back in June to talk about his new novel called All the Light We Cannot See. It's the story of a French girl and a German boy during the occupation of France in World War II. Doerr is going to be in Utah next week for a pair of events as part of the Utah Humanity Council's Book Festival, and we'll give you those details as we go along. So I wanted to ask you about, so this thing took you 10 years, right?
It did.
And I'm thinking about, did it have to take 10 years, do you think? I mean, because you write about, you write a lovely memoir, Four Seasons in Rome. And you go to Rome, you get this, it's a grant, right? To go, it's an award to go spend a year with your family in Rome. Unbelievable. And you're writing this book, The Time. But in that memoir, you write about your sense of frustration for writing this book. And there are a couple of things going on, at least that I got from it. Kind of the self-doubt, I think, maybe, or something's coming through in that. But also, how do you put it in the book? I actually want to find this. You talk about how you say, I haven't finished a piece of fiction since the boys were born. I want to write about this French radio resistance, but I can't speak French. You talk about all these kinds of sense of frustration. And then you say, when I look at copies of my first books, even the novel that I published, they seem like strange and reticent objects. What it wasn't writer's block, really, but what was it?
I mean, not to make a joke of it, but it was just lack of sleep. We had twin boys. Moved to Rome. I mean, the prize was an amazing thing. It's called the Rome Prize, and they send you there to work. But the day we found out about that prize, my wife gave birth to twin boys. So I, you know, bring this letter back to the hospital. I'm like, hey, do you want to see this now? So, you know, they were 6 months when we went, but I had never, you know, I live in Boise, Idaho. It's smaller than Salt Lake. I had never lived in a city as big as Rome. You know, there's car alarms all night. The babies are crying. And, you know, reading is a big part of my writing life. And suddenly all my time to read is sort of evaporating. And I was falling in love with the city of Rome. And I was so used to being in my little office in Boise, dreaming about other places and being able to use sentences to kind of transport myself and hopefully my reader.
And now you're there.
Spots. And suddenly now I was in this very compelling place. So I wrote a book of nonfiction, you know, while I was there out of my notes. And That's really probably the only time I'll do that, unless I move to another strange place. I find travel and reading, somehow they both help crack this skin of familiarity that forms around your life. You know, there are days when I bike or drive to work, and I don't even really remember the drive to work necessarily. And Tolstoy has this beautiful line in his diaries where he talks about dusting a couch and then 5 minutes later can't remember if he dusted his couch or not. And he says, if whole lives of people go on unconsciously, such as this, then such lives are as if they had never been. It's really a harrowing line to me. It's a reminder that if you're not being conscious and paying attention to what you're seeing and what you're doing, then you're really not alive. Your life doesn't count. And so for me, travel and reading, and particularly that year in Rome when people aren't speaking English around you, it forces you to feel a lot more awareness. It's tiring, yes, but it's living. You're living. You know, you're really seeing things. And so when I'm home and things are more familiar, I feel like I use fiction to do that. I'm able to see things by imagining them. And that way I get to live in kind of two worlds at once. But when you're traveling, sometimes the fiction falls by the wayside. It's much harder for me. So that's part of the reason this book took 10 years. Yeah.
You were distracted.
Yes, I was. I was falling in love with the city. You know, you'd be like buying Pampers in this market, and this was a place where emperors had flooded a whole square and had naval battles, you know, 2,000 years before. You know, in Boise, a century home is a big deal. And, you know, the apartment we lived in Rome was 500 years old, you know.
I want to come back to Werner, who is, as you tell it in the book, he's really gifted, and he's asked by this prominent Nazi commander to come and fix this radio, and he does. And it, and really, in some way, this is kind of the beginning of this sense of conflict that he feels inside of himself. And it's a big part of the story, I think, because he knows these gifts are going to get him out of this rat hole of a place where he lives. He knows he's not going to have to, if he can marshal these gifts, he doesn't have to go down into the mine where his father, as you say, was crushed and killed. But he also knows, he also has this sense of reticence about that something about this is not right. And there's this moment in the book where he crushes this radio that he's built, kind of as this expression of what? Like kind of resignation and guilt?
Part of it is his sister, who has a even though she's younger, she has a much purer and truer moral compass, and she has been listening late at night to foreign radio broadcasts. And I think it's 37, forgive me if I have the year slightly wrong, around 1937, listening to foreign broadcasts becomes punishable by hard labor. Later it becomes punishable by death. And so his sister is risking everything to listen to, because she can speak French, she's listening to updates on the invasion of France later. And so in some ways, he's crushing the radio. Both, you know, it's a sacrifice of his child, but he crushes it so that, you know, she can't get in trouble. And, you know, even when he's called to fix the radio of this party official, he's worried at first that maybe they know. You know, there's this sense, this terror that the Third Reich, the powers of the Third Reich can see through walls and see into everybody's hearts. And that's why, you know, everybody's so shy. So it's one way for me to try to dramatize the sense of all knowingness, all seeingness and fear that everybody was living under at that time.
There's a he goes into this national institute. It's like this Hitler Youth school, very elite, but incredibly terrifying, yes. Horrifying, at least in terms of the way things happen. And one thing you write about, which I just wanted you to say something briefly about, because you must have done some research on this, and these raciological exams, this idea of race. Now, Werner has all the right stuff. He's blonde, super blonde, in fact. He's got the blue eyes. He looks like the typical Aryan. So he's going to pass. It's going to be okay. But that's part of the exam. That's
yes.
part of
yeah.
life.
They run these kids through all kinds of physical drills, mental exams, in which some of the questions laced into these exams are really good questions about science or how does a rainbow work? And then the next question is, what's the birthday of the Führer? And then the next is like, what's Germany's greatest writer? And you better get it right. And then they had men examining these children for raciological, you know, like how blue their eyes are, or they had little scales, chromatic scales to measure their hair color, all with this horrifying eugenics idea of purifying the race and winnowing out the chaff. And yeah, it's just horrifying. And I'm not making any of that stuff, the stuff that he goes through. In fact, in some ways, I toned down some of the brutality at the school. You know, some of these things, these boys, especially towards the end of the war when they needed soldiers, you know, they're sending really young 15, 16-year-old kids into battle.
It's kind of this Lord of the Flies sort of thing that comes up. And there's this terrific character, Frederick, who emerges, loves birds. He's a friend of Werner, but he's weak. Weak, yes. In the scheme of things, and
weak by their definition.
By their definition, weak. And Werner, I don't want to say too much about this, but he kind of looks the other way, and this is, it seems like a part of the book that we're kind of, I think I heard it described this way. We're testing Werner's decency,
and he fails for most of the book. I think he fails. He fails to stay in Solferein, that coal mining town, with his sister. And then he fails to help Frederick in these moments, you know. I mean, there is something to Werner's character that he is Frederick's one friend. Yeah. You know, you get a sense that Frederick is more different than Werner. There's a line at the end of the book, one of the characters says, what the war did to dreamers. And that was really my motivation with that character, Frederick. He's in love with Audubon. He owns a copy, which becomes, you know, frowned upon. His parents are ashamed of. He owns a copy of Birds of America. And, yeah, he can identify birds by their calls. And in some ways, you know, he's more engaged with the natural world than any of these other boys are. But they sense that he's weak. He's absent-minded. He forgets to tie his shoes. He's not polishing his boots the way they expect him to. And ultimately, he pays a terrible price for that.
There is this idea of light in the title and, again, throughout the book, which you talked about. And there's this crucial moment that plays out early on in the story. Werner and his sister, they're listening to the radio. You mentioned that he's been listening to this French scientist. And this is the, I guess this is the first time he really comes across this broadcast, this particular moment. And the voice that he's listening in that French accent says that the brain is locked in total darkness, but the world it constructs in the mind is full of light. You've got these two contrasting things going on. And so the voice asks, how is the brain going to build? How does it do it? How does it build this world of light? How did this come to you first before you read this? Where did this idea come to you?
That's a good question. I review science books for the Boston Globe. Yeah. I have for a long time. I'm sure I was reading something where some scientist wrote some similar sentence, something about the brain is locked in this dark fluid and yet it's building this really vibrant, colorful world for us all the time. It's just an interesting paradox to me. I like that. I'm always, anytime I can cram another metaphor about light and color into the book, I was, you know. And I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's really important to try to, you know, here's this really dark backdrop of what he's growing up against, you know, coal mining town, there's soot raining all the time. Here's these two little white-haired children, like these little flames moving against that dark backdrop. Yeah. And what if this streak of light comes in from somewhere else, this, you know, a competent educator for children in science, what if he gets to listen to that on the radio? So I loved writing these little broadcasts for the, you know, that he would listen to. It was fun for me. The broadcast hisses and pops. What is this? Whispers Jutta. Werner does not answer. The Frenchman's voice is velvet. His accent is very different from Frau Elena's, and yet his voice is so ardent, so hypnotizing, that Werner finds he can understand every word. The Frenchman talks about optical illusions, electromagnetism. There's a pause and a peal of static, as though a record is being flipped, and then he enthuses about coal. Consider a single piece glowing in your family's stove. See it, children? That chunk of coal was once a green plant, a fern or reed that lived 1 million years ago, or maybe 2 million, or maybe 100 million. Can you imagine 100 million years? Every summer, for the whole life of that plant, its leaves caught what light they could and transformed the sun's energy into itself, into bark, twigs, stems. Because plants eat light in much the way we eat food. But then the plant died and fell, probably into water, and decayed into peat, and the peat was folded inside the earth for years upon years, eons, in which something like a month or a decade or even your whole life was just a puff of air, a snap of two fingers. And eventually the peat dried and became like stone, and someone dug it up, and the coal man brought it to your house, and maybe you yourself carried it to the stove, and now that sunlight, sunlight 100 million years old, is heating your home tonight. Time slows. The attic disappears. Yutta disappears. Has anyone ever spoken so intimately about the very things Werner is most curious about? Open your eyes, concludes the man, and see what you can with them before they close forever. And then a piano comes on, playing a lonely song that sounds to Werner like a golden boat traveling a dark river, a progression of harmonies that transfigures sulfurine, the houses turned to mist, the mines filled in, the smokestacks fallen, an ancient sea spilling through the streets, and the air streaming with possibility.
Anthony Doerr, his novel is called All the Light We Cannot See. We spoke with him back in June. Doerr is going to be in Utah next week for a pair of events as part of the Utah Humanity Council's 2014 Book Festival. We have all the details of those free events on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Anthony Doerr. We're rebroadcasting our conversation we had with him back in June about his new novel called All the Light We Cannot See. So Saint Malo is an important setting here, of course. It's where we end up in the novel. And you've talked about the first time you saw that city. You write about seeing it at night at low tide and being just kind of like captivated, I guess. And then the realization that, this is really ancient. And then your book editor said, well, the Americans really blasted this place and almost destroyed it during the war. Talk about that as a setting to you, because that place is a really important part of the story.
Yeah, you just spoke about it perfectly. I was on book tour in France, and as glamorous as that sounds, occasionally you get a little tired, and we pulled into this town at night, and we had this long dinner where everybody's smoking and saying, like, Anthony, tell me more about your
very kids. French, yes. Right? Yeah.
And I was, ready to just get away from the cigarette smoke, to be honest. And it was pretty late. It was probably 9 or 10, and I finally got out and walked up a staircase and found myself atop the ramparts, these old walls that encircled the citadel, really old medieval walls that were originally meant to protect from seafaring invaders. The whole town is barely connected to France just by this little spit of sand. So it's almost an island. And, to walk on that, you're really about three stories up. So you can see into the third stories of apartments on your left, and then the ocean. It was low tide and the moon is, glinting off all this wet sand. And I thought, I've stepped into a fairy tale. I've stepped into like an Italo Calvino invisible city, some kind of fairy city. And once my editor explained to me that the American and British, the Allies forces had bombed this city repeatedly for about a 7-day siege. This was about 2 months after D-Day. This is in August of 1944. We had the Allies had made pretty significant penetration towards Paris, maybe halfway. And yet here on Brittany, the Germans were so entrenched. They used these old corsairs, these state-sanctioned pirates, these old tunnels underneath the city, and they had fortified them over the whole 4 years of the occupation, particularly in the last 2 years when they were building the Atlantic Wall. They had fortified them with cement. The Germans had air conditioning. They had a direct line to Berlin. They had an underground hospital. They had water to last for months and enough ammunition supposedly to last for a year. And we had the Allies had no real sense of how many Germans were there. And so they probably the Allies probably used way too much artillery and aerial bombardment. This is the first time napalm was ever used in warfare. It was in Saint-Malo. So once I knew that, I had been searching for where this boy in the story might be trapped. Huh. And once I had visited this town, I thought, oh, this is it. These old, impregnable, unimpregnable cellars that these corsairs had built for their loot. What if I put him in one of these? That'd be basically a de facto bomb shelter. And what if I had the girl nearby in the town with a transmitter? And that's really when the novel started to come together.
Hmm. I loved the Hotel of Bees.
Yes, he's trapped inside the Hotel of Bees. That's an invented thing.
Is it? I wondered about that. I wondered if it was someplace. I loved it, though, I have to say. It was such a nice detail.
Yeah, thanks. There are these amazing, you know, these cool old mansions that have been turned into hotels there. And in the upper rooms, you can see the sea, and you can walk right out onto the ramparts from these rooms. And it's really a romantic place. And it's so painstakingly rebuilt that it takes you time. It takes you a couple of weeks before you start to see, you know, what was built in the 50s and is covered with slightly younger lichen. Or, you know, sometimes you can see where the old walls meet newer blocks that have been placed in the walls.
People have described the book as having a kind of fairy tale quality to it. Like it's a fable. And there is this part... we don't have to say too much about it because it's a great part of the mystery, I have to say. But there's this legendary mythical diamond, the Sea of Flames. And it's great because it kind of comes with a fable, the story that Marie hears when she's young, this old museum volunteer, I guess. He's a tour guide, really. And he tells the story of how this prince plucks this diamond, which he thought was just this beautiful blue stone from this dry riverbank. And the story sort of takes off from there. But there is that kind of – where did that come from, that fable quality to this?
You know, it was something all along that I was just playing with. There's a – you know, she's the princess in the tower. There's an enchanted stone. There's this really unlikely knight of the boy who may or may not be able to rescue her. Or she may not rescue him. And there's an ogre really in the story and this German who's hunting for the diamond, von Rumpel. So I've always just kind of been in love with the dreaminess of fairy tales. And without I just felt like, you know, there are so many books written about World War II. I didn't want to tell a story about the horrors of the Holocaust. I feel like if our schools have done a good enough job, an American reader anyway will be able to feel underneath the text the Holocaust hanging underneath it. And so I didn't want to shine the light directly on it as much as feel it beneath really every sentence of the novel. This is what's happening underneath Werner's town, behind this awful paramilitary school he's sent to. This is what these boys are being trained to do. And so I thought, you know, one way to try to tell a slightly different kind of story is to infuse it with these fairy tale elements. And yet the magic in the story for me is not the diamond, which you never really learn whether or not it's truly cursed. It's the natural world. It's electromagnetism. It's radio, you know. And that was the preeminent magic of the time. The book begins with an epigraph that says, without the airplane, without the radio, the German Revolution could never have happened. And, you know, I think that's right. I think that's true.
There is, I want to have you read another section here. And, you know, we're going to be careful not to give too much away, but there is a moment, and it comes, as I mentioned in the introduction, quite a bit later in the book when there is an encounter. What can we say about that, Anthony Doerr? That, because there's a beautiful moment where she begins to read.
Yeah. Marie and Werner, their stories are told in alternating chapters, really an A-B-A-B kind of structure. The chapters are very short. There's 187 in the book and just about two or three pages, and it alternates back and forth. And I hope the reader feels them about to intersect all along. And as you mentioned early in the show, it's about page 400 before they finally meet. And this is right before that moment. I think all the listener really needs to know is that there's a radio transmitter in the attic of the house in Saint-Malo where Marie is. And she's been trapped in this attic for several days now and has decided to turn on this transmitter and try to just broadcast, whether it's to her great uncle who owns the transmitter or maybe somebody else out there who might be able to help her. She traces the lines of the cables until she is sure she has the microphone in her hand. To shut your eyes is to guess nothing of blindness. Beneath your world of skies and faces and buildings exists a rawer and older world, a place where surface planes disintegrate and sounds ribbon in shoals through the air. Marie can sit in an attic high above the street and hear lilies rustling in marshes 2 miles away. She hears Americans scurry across farm fields, directing their huge cannons at the smoke of Saint-Malo. She hears families sniffling around hurricane lamps and cellars, crows hopping from pile to pile, flies landing on corpses in ditches. She hears the tamarinds shiver and the jays shriek and the dune grass burn. She feels the great granite fist sunk deep into the earth's crust on which San Malo sits, and the ocean teething at it from all four sides, and the outer islands holding steady against the swirling tides. She hears cows drink from stone troughs and dolphins rise through the green water of the channel. She hears the bones of dead whales stir 5 leagues below, their marrow offering a century of food for cities of creatures who will live their whole lives and never once see a photon sent from the sun. She hears her snails in the grotto drag their bodies over the rocks. Rather than my reading it to you, maybe you could read it to me. With her free hand, she opens the novel in her lap, finds the lines with her fingers, brings the microphone to her lips.
You once described your camera as your most prized possession, because you said it helped you pay attention to the world. I wanted to come back around to that because that's sort of the thing that got you started with all of this. There's this essay you wrote for Wired magazine where you write about this dark twin who lives inside you. You call him Z, this dark twin. And it's the twin who wants to read the news feeds and look at the email all the time. And it's probably just like the guy in the subway, right? But you say this, you say, and speaking of light, you describe your computer as possessing its own blessed fountain of light. But you say that demand to feel connected is tilting us toward derangement, is how you put it. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, this idea coming back around to the, I guess, the idea of paying attention, being aware.
Sure. Yeah, I have a very strong love-hate relationship with the little black iPhone in my pocket. I love to feel connected. I love learning that it's a friend's birthday or seeing pictures of somebody in Spain who I haven't seen in 3 years. And I like learning if, something good finally is happening in Syria, or if, you know, the United States is going to have a good match in the World Cup. You know, I love being able to learn that no matter where I am in the world. So I'm not a technophobe at all. But I do think that this little twin inside of me has become so addicted to that there are times when I forget to be where I am, particularly where I'm traveling. I went to the Arctic last year for, it was about 9 days total. I was way north of the Arctic Circle and I had no connection to anything. And while I miss my family very deeply, I noticed by about day three, I had become very happy just going a lot more slowly and spending an hour or two walking and looking and seeing. You know, plus it was light 24 hours a day. So it felt like I was almost on this drug of light pouring into my eyes all day. And I worry that I miss that. You know, airplanes for me are these really protected spaces where I read, and now Wi-Fi is starting to become available and I'm tempted. I have a lot of email to answer. I'm like, oh, maybe I should log on and spend $6. Like, no, just protect that few hours and read and sit and think. And, you know, I think solitude and thought are something that we really need to protect and defend and think about that with our children, the way my children are so quick with their iPads. You know, I want them to be able to dream. You know, a lot of my quote-unquote productive or unproductive time as a child was sitting there and playing in the woods and running around with toys and living in the present and living now and in that place. When I'm overseas, I miss my wife and kids so much. I love getting these little pings from home, but what they do is they tear you out of the place you're in momentarily. And you know, that's something that you need to guard against every once in a while. You need to make sure you're not checking your email 20 times a day. Maybe 10 times a day is enough.
Do you when you're writing, do you have to get into is it the same? Is writing like taking a walk where you're immersed? You know, are you immersed in that experience too?
Yes, on the good days. I'll admit I bought this $5 program for my computer called Freedom. Have you heard of it?
No.
It is an app that totally disables all the networking on your computer for as many minutes as you tell it to.
Wow.
And it helped me finish this book. So I would take these big, ambitious, like 190 minutes now I will write. And I would notice after I'd read through a chapter, revise some bit of the text, then I would notice my finger guiding the mouse towards my email program before I'd say, like, oh, yeah, of course that's not going to work. I told it not to work. So I'd always have to trick myself into it. But yes, that's what you need, these long, sustained periods where you're dreaming and imagining yourself into some other world. You know, writing is an act of concentration and dreaming, and that's what reading is too. You know, sometimes you need to switch things off. That's why I am thrilled that so many people are reading books on e-readers. But for me to read on a device that could also play Words with Friends or something would be dangerous for me. I think I'd be too tempted to close the book app and open some other app. So I like good old paper books because there's only one app in a paper book.
I want to see this finally, which sort of brings us back to this idea of the book and the setting of World War II. And you've talked about that, how now we've sort of moved as the people who were alive during World War II are dying off, that it's we're shifting away from memory to history. And that's something that I'm not sure if it worries you, but that you're thinking about lately.
Yes. Yeah. I end the book with a little set piece. I won't say, I guess I won't give much away, but yes, that I, where I talk about that. And there's a line that every day we're losing people for whom the war is memory. And certainly in 10 or 15 years, maybe 15 years, there would be almost nobody left for whom the war is memory. In terms of worry, the things that worry me are how, say, young American children are learning about the war. History Channel can be responsible, but sometimes they present things almost like a video game. Certainly video games are, I don't want to throw a blanket on it, but in most places they're presenting a very straightforward good versus evil narrative where not a lot of effort is spent thinking about how did Germany get to this place? How did these soldiers get in this position? And aren't these just young kids also? And then, you know, I think about the way politicians use the war, too. It's this narrative that's always conjured up, still really prevalent in the way we talk about warfare, you know, because they feel like there was this moral clarity in D-Day. And there was in a lot of ways. But this is still, you know, acts of utter violence on both sides. You know, if you go back and think about World War One, you know, people are dying to fight over yards, literally yards. And now these are places that trucks can carry toilet paper past at 60 kilometers an hour. And so I think it's important to, when you're thinking about history, to read the narratives that offer some level of complexity, you know, and make you try to empathize with both sides or make you think really deeply. What would it be like, say, in Salt Lake City if an invading army was coming in a month? What kind of things would need to be moved and protected? And, you know, how would people respond? You know, so that's what I hope good fiction, good narratives of any kind can do.
Anthony Doerr, his latest novel is called All the Light We Cannot See. We spoke with him back in June. Doerr is going to be in Utah next week for a pair of events. It's all part of the Utah Humanity Council's Book Festival. We have all of the details about those events on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.